Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello, folks, and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today's Good Growing with the Garden Guy. We have Gary Heilig here with Sue Majeure and yours truly, Tom Majeure. Gary, welcome.
Happy to be here again, although I'm not too happy about the season.
it's probably because it's the end. You should be happy. It's harvest season.
Yeah, but I had COVID when it was time to plant, so I didn't have a lot to harvest this year.
Oh, that will be a sad season. And Sue, welcome back, joining us from Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Oh, I'm glad to be here as well.
Sue, would you start us out with a word of prayer?
Certainly. Heavenly Father, thank you for this program that we're able to do and those who have contributed to it. And I help us to have an opportunity to get to know you better through your second book, Nature, because it teaches us so much about your character and how we want to be as close to your character as we can, because it's all we get to take to heaven. So help us learn today, and thank you for all of your bounty in nature and in growing. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Amen. You know, Gary and Sue and listeners, I was reading a passage, and it said that the nature is the second book. It's how we get to know God, but we interpret nature from the scriptures. And so there's that interaction of nature and the scriptures. The scriptures help us to interpret nature. I think that's a wonderful thought.
I think it is too. And when I was reading the Sabbath school lesson this week, I thought about something interesting. It talked about how God is being love, and love has to be expressed. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, if that's the case, then that's why he created the universe, to express his love. And then I went a step further and said, and the magnitude of his love is measured by the size of the universe, which is always increasing, as they say.
Right.
So
his love is increasing.
Yeah, his love is increasing. And for those of you that don't know, there are other beings in this creation. Don't be so self-centered, narcissistic to think that he would produce literally billions of galaxies and we're the only ones here.
Well, not only that, Gary, I was going to go in a different direction. The nature is so complex and so marvelous. That's an expression of his love, is this nature. Others have said it, and I'm just repeating it. He could have made everything monochromic, bichromic, mm-hmm. white and black, but he made it all colors across the rainbow and it's just amazing. So yeah. Our God is love, and it's expressed in everything, including gardening, which is our discussion. It's October, Gary, and it must be time for the October quiz.
Yeah, so speaking of creation, I had the first question is, what plant produces the smallest flower in the world?
Boy, I know...
I think I know this one.
You know, Gary, you always challenge me, and you just seem to make it easy on Sue. So you must be playing favorites.
Well,
here.
She hasn't answered it yet. So.
Okay. Sue, I defer to you as always.
I read that I don't know that I'm accurate, but I read this somewhere. And Tom, you actually know what this plant is,
well,
if I'm right.
I am so glad. I just can't recall it.
I think it's duckweed.
Duckweed.
You're in the right genus. So it's called water meal, and it's Wolfia globosa, and it's found all over the place. It is in the duckweed genus, and it's about the size of a grain of rice. So, yeah, you're right.
Remember
about
that. Remember we used to see at the bird sanctuary, Tom?
Yes.
Floating on the surface and the ducks eating it?
I do recall.
And so that plant has a flower, but most people probably never notice it.
What color is the smallest flower in the world?
It probably doesn't have a color. If anything, if I was going to say what I thought it might be white. Mm. But it's going to be so small, it's going to be insignificant. All right, let's go to the other end. And I think we might have asked this question once. What is the largest flower in the world?
Oh, I think it's Rafflesia.
That's right. It's also called the monster flower. Now, a lot of people might have thought about the other flower, the corpse flower, and that's a common name for this one and another one, which is actually, I guess it's Amorphophallus titanium, and they both smell really bad. They reek of rotting meat.
So tell me, how large is large?
This one can grow up to 3 feet in diameter.
No way.
And weigh up to 15 pounds.
I was thinking the range of 6 to 12 inches.
No, it's a big flower, and it's found in the rainforests of Malaysia and Indonesia. So it's
probably the reason I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's not like we're going to trip over it anywhere soon.
I think you'd have to go around it. I don't think you'd trip over it.
Well, you could if you were Shaq.
Yeah. Hey, looks like you got another question for us.
This one's on grapes.
Okay.
What country, and I have a couple on grapes, what country produces the most grapes in tonnage?
Could it be Italy?
Close. Italy comes in second place.
Is it nearby?
Then France.
No help. France is in the top five. They're number four.
What about Greece?
Nope, they're not even in the top five.
Okay. I was way off the base.
Spain is number three. The U.S. is number five. Who is number one?
Germany?
I would think of a place that has a lot of people.
China?
That's it.
Okay.
And they produce about 14 million tons every year. And the next country, Italy, produces about half of that.
Well, they're a fraction of the size.
You never hear about a Chinese wine industry, I guess.
Well, I'm sure they do some wine, but they also eat a lot of fresh grapes. And they consume just about everything they grow. So, but anyway.
So we don't hear about it.
No, you'd be surprised how many places China's number one producer. They just produce a lot of food. And guess what else? China is buying up farmland in the United States. And just recently, I think Governor DeSantis was working on something to prevent them from buying Florida farmland. Because I don't think it's a good idea to let somebody buy your farmland when you can't even own land in China. Not even the citizens can own the land. They lease it.
There's a philosophical difference there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of an alarming precedent, isn't it?
It is and it isn't. Because what do countries do when they get fed up with other countries taking advantage of them?
You say, no more for you.
No, they just nationalize it. Like you nationalize the oil industry. What the United States sells, they can take it back. But anyway, the next one also deals with grapes. What is, in terms of weight, is the largest bunch of grapes on record? And this was from Spain in 2018. Largest bunch of grapes, how much do you think it weighed?
Well, you know, when they went into the Promised Land, they had a grapes that they brought back that were on a pole between two people. So I would say there's some standard there.
Right, but they didn't weigh it. And they certainly didn't use English or the metric system to measure it. So we have to leave them out. Pardon?
Grapes have a lot of water or fluid in them, so...
What is your guess?
I think it'd be kind of weighty.
Well, most fruits are majority water.
Well, yeah, but some of them, like apples, have air in them, too, so...
Yes, they do.
I was just kind of wondering, thinking about how, you know, much water there would be in grapes, so... I never got to see the size of that cluster, so just guessing, 200 pounds.
Oh, Lord, no. No, 22.31 pounds for one, the biggest cluster that they had
from Spain. Oh, here I was imagining something larger. Guess I was thinking about that that bunch of grapes that the spies brought in to Israel.
Yeah, but we don't have any records on how heavy they were. So, and I also gave you a hint. I said it was from Spain. So this is the current world's record. We can't go back to antiquity because if you can imagine before the flood, they're probably bigger than the ones that they went into the promised land to get.
That's true. That's true. What about the most expensive grape? Is this a plant or is this the grape itself, the fruit?
Well, actually, the most expensive grape are called Ruby Roman, and they're a red grape. And in 2020, one bunch sold at auction for $12,000.
And
why are they so expensive?
Same question I had.
Well, they're only grown in one place in Japan. They're grown in greenhouses. And they prune these grapes so that they are down to a single bunch. The bunches aren't much larger than maybe if you put three of a man's fist together. That's okay. About how big the bunch is.
Is it overvalued?
Well, you have to remember in Japan, they do different things with fruit. They use fruit as a gift for giving and for special occasions and things like that. It's not like you go into Meijer and you find just goodles of fruit everywhere. They're much more specific about things. They control the temperature. They control the amount of water the plants get. They even have a card that they compare the color of the developing grapes. And if they're not developing color at the rate that they think they should be, they will clip leaves off or they'll actually shade. They'll put little pieces of white paper or cloth, I'm not sure which one it is, over the individual clusters so that they get the perfect color.
Wow.
And in order for these grapes to be considered the ideal grapes are about four times the regular size of a grape, and they must weigh at least 20 grams a piece.
How much is 20 grams?
Well, 2.52 grams is an ounce, I believe.
Okay.
So we're talking about 10 ounces.
And 10 ounces.
Yeah. And they have to have at least 18% sugar, and they're very juicy. Now, they have three different, I guess you might call them classifications for these grapes. And what they have is what they call the superior grapes. That's the lowest standard, but it's superior to all the other grapes that are grown there. And it's a very small percentage of all these grapes that they grow. Only a very few of them get these special designations. And the superior ones run between $90 and $140 a bunch. And remember, that bunch is not much bigger than this.
Three hands.
Yeah, three hands, yeah. I only have this. Two, so. And then they have the special superior. They run about $180 to $400 a bunch. And then out of all of those grapes that they grow, only one to two bunches a year, and sometimes not even that, get what's called the premium designation. Wow. And those can be $1,000 or up. And, if, of course, as I said, when they had an auction, one group went for $12,000. So those are some expensive grapes.
And it's not like it's has a long shelf life or anything?
No, they probably don't last long at all. They get eaten pretty quickly. But in
I saw on a program where they had this, like, a hall of fruits and vegetables in a store there in Japan. And like you described, there were no insect holes. Everything was like absolutely perfect and polished.
Absolutely perfect.
Like a jewelry in the store.
These grapes are put in gift boxes. So, in 2020, only 25,000 clusters even were at the level where they would call them the Ruby Romans. And there's, you know, many, many thousands of tons of grapes grown in Japan. But again, they're grown in only one area of Japan. Now, this next one is a couple of questions. Same fruit. What fruit has no blossoms on its branches? The blossom is inside the fruit. And was at one time given as an Olympic medal? And the third clue is one half of a serving contains more calcium than a half a cup of milk.
Sue said fig, so.
And Sue would be right. Sue, I'm impressed. I am definitely impressed. And what state are most figs grown in the United States? 98% production there.
California?
Yep, 98% were grown in California. And the Mission figs were the first ones to come here, and they came early in the 16th century.
Hmm.
So
were they at the missions there?
Most likely they were. Most likely they were, because somebody had to start growing them. So it's interesting, too. This is a fruit that's allowed to start to dry on the tree before it's harvested, which is not something that you normally do with fruit. It's a very, very different plant.
Now, California is a large state, and there's different agricultural zones across California. Is this in northern, central, or southern California?
Well, figs are going to probably be central to southern because they don't take frost very well. And if you get up into northern California, they get snow. And although depending on the type of fig it is, it might survive, because I know a lady that grows figs here in Michigan. But she has to do a lot of protective type things to keep it in good shape.
Well, awesome.
So another thing I wanted to talk about today was the world food situation.
Okay.
And we all know what's going on in Russia and Ukraine. And it's interesting, and I might have mentioned this in our last program, that the majority of the potash or potassium that we use in fertilizers comes from Russia. The majority of the phosphate that's in fertilizer comes from China. And everybody's getting a little nervous about that. And fertilizer prices have definitely gone up as a result. And China's no longer shipping phosphate outside the country. They're keeping it for themselves. And, of course, because of the lack of fertilizer, yields in a lot of places are going to be down. And experts are now predicting that we might have as many as 100 to 150 million people die as a result of food shortages. But right now, we're still eating last year's food. So the problem comes when they have this harvest and we start getting the reports in, which will start coming in the fall, October, November, as to what kind of stores we're going to have for the future. I'll tell you what I'm doing.
What are you doing?
I'm buying fertilizer now for next year, because the prices are only going to go up.
Okay.
And you might.
Well, we're starting to see. I was at Meijer's on Monday, and, you know, we all complained when fresh cherries, were $5.99 a pound or $6.99 a pound. We're like, that's ridiculous. You know, they should be $3.99, $4.99 a pound, which is what we're used to. I was in there Monday. They were $9.99 a pound.
Yeah.
And there was nobody buying them. I don't know why Meijer's decided to buy them and put that price on them, because I don't think anybody's going to buy them, and they'll just spoil.
They might. They'll try to mark them down, of course, but that's what it's costing. But see, Meijer's throws out stuff all the time. So if they find that nobody's going to buy them at these prices, they'll just stop bringing them in.
Well, folks, that completes the first segment of Good Growing with the Garden Guy. We'll be back shortly. Stay tuned.
Hi, folks. Jelaine Fenner here. We are definitely living in uncertain times, and for some of us, it's scary. Signs of the times are everywhere. Jesus is coming back soon. Read Revelation chapter 22. Jesus says, "Surely I am coming quickly." We at Strong Tower Radio have a free book for you called The Great Controversy. Go to the back of the book and read chapters 35 to 42. It'll help you understand the times we're living in and what's ahead. This book even has 800 historical quotes and 1,200 Bible quotes. I love this book. Call Strong Tower Radio today, 231-468-2087, and ask for The Great Controversy while supplies last. And if we don't answer, please leave a message asking for The Great Controversy with your name, address, and phone number. That's 231-468-2087 on Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Welcome back, folks. This is Good Growing with the Garden Guy. I am Tom Majeur with Sue, and we are interviewing Gary Heilig. He's a retired Michigan State Extension agent in the area of horticulture, and we really appreciate it. Talking with Gary, he says that we've been doing this since 2017, so we must be coming up on an anniversary here or something.
If you say so, Tom.
Okay. That sounds like 5 years to me. Yeah. Well, Gary, there's a number of things. We kind of ended the last segment on a bit of a sobering note, but give us some heads up and how to prepare for next year.
Let's stay on a sober note.
Okay.
Normally, people will wait until, say, January when all the seed catalogs come out to buy their seeds. And I expect those prices are going to be up too. But I'm going to be buying my seeds in the next couple of weeks. So we don't really know what the food situation will be next week or next year, because it's too early to tell. But it would be a good idea that if you have not been gardening, you may want to have a garden just in case things get so expensive that you can't afford them, because you can certainly grow it at home less expensive than you can just go to the store and buy things. And if you're going to have a garden, one of the things I would suggest you do is grow the most nutritionally dense materials. Everything like eggplant, for instance, isn't known to be high in nutrients as compared to some other things.
Well, the same thing with watermelon. It tastes great, but it's not nutritionally dense.
Oh, it's got a lot of potassium in it.
It does have some nutrients, but and all of the vegetables have some nutrients, but some are more nutrient dense than others. And what do you think would be one of the biggest ones that people suggest, but we don't eat very much
well,
of?
Well, let me ask you this question. Define nutrient dense. What classifies is dense versus thin or light?
When we say nutrient dense, we're talking about how many nutrients and how much of a variety of nutrients does something have? Because you not only have vitamins in your vegetables, but you also have minerals. So vitamins would be A, C, K, E, those types of things. Whereas the minerals would be things like potassium, magnesium, manganese, boron. And then you have other things like omega-3 fatty acids, omega-6 fatty acids. If you've had Vicky on, she's talked about those things.
I was thinking we need to get a nutrition on here. Yeah.
Protein content. So there are different levels in the different vegetables. And probably one of the ones that most people do not eat that's just packed with nutrition is kale.
Ah.
So you certainly should.
They need to come to our house. We have an abundance.
Okay, you better be ready to share.
Okay.
If the bottom falls out of the grocery stores, I'm sure people are going to find you, Tom. But anyway.
Is there a difference in the different kales? Because I know there's curly kale, there's dinosaur kale, there's red kale.
I'm sure there's some slight differences. Now, in the red kales, you're going to have things like anthocyanins, which are antioxidants. But to know that for sure, I would suggest you go to nutritiondata.com and look them up, because they do give you a full list of vitamins, minerals, fatty acids, protein content, and other things. It even used to, I don't know if it still does, it would tell you how much it'll satiate you with a serving. In other words, are you going to get hungry in a few minutes, or will it stay with you for a long time? And an example would be if you're eating something like, let's say, baby bok choy, you're going to get hungrier a lot faster than you would if you had just eaten pinto beans, because they have a lot of fiber in them. They have a lot of protein in them. It takes a while for your body to digest all of that. And it's going to keep you you won't get hungry as quickly.
So that was that nutrition.com?
Yeah, nutritiondata.com.
Data, okay. Mm-hmm. Nutritiondata.com.
But kale.
Can we grow
Pardon?
Quinoa. Can we grow quinoa in our in Michigan here? Because I saw somebody had amaranth plants, and I got to wondering about that. Because quinoa has lots of protein and fiber.
I don't see why you couldn't, but being able to deal with grains is a little different. It's much more labor-intensive. So you can grow wheat, oats, barley, all of those different things. The question is harvesting and cleaning it, and storing it, drying it, then storing it. There's quite a bit to be done, but there's no reason why you couldn't do it. And so when you look at kale, it has lots of vitamin C, vitamin A, vitamin K1, B6, potassium, calcium, magnesium, copper, manganese.
It's the wonder vegetable.
It is. And I don't eat a lot of kale myself, but I'm definitely going to increase it. And there are kales that you can dry into chips, and they're quite good. I like kale chips.
Yeah, we have quite a supply.
And well, and it's
good
even
with nutritional yeast sprinkled on them.
Yeah, people do that. And kale is even more nutritious than spinach. And another one that's good is garlic. And it's not something you're going to eat a lot of, but garlic has a lot of nutrition also. And it has selenium and manganese and copper again and B1. Even has some C. And garlic is a material that naturally will lower blood pressure. And there's a product in it called allicin. And allicin is best used when the garlic is raw. So if you crush up garlic and let it sit for a few minutes, then you're going to get the best benefit as opposed to cooking it.
Hmm.
So when you're making a guacamole, use fresh garlic in it.
Okay.
And so another one is one of my favorite vegetables to grow because it's like digging up treasure. That would be potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And potatoes are very high in potassium. They have, they also have protein in them, and they have iron, some of the B vitamins. So it's a good all around plant, and it does take care of satiety. In other words, you are filled by it. And of course, you can use potatoes in so many different ways. And I just never get tired of potatoes, so that's the nice thing.
So how does satiety, if I said the word correctly, relate to satiation?
It's just a different form of the
okay.
same word.
Okay.
In other words, it fills you up and it stays with you for a while. And then, of course, things like broccoli, onions, we mentioned spinach already, bell peppers, zucchini, green beans, tomatoes, all of these things are good vegetables to grow. Peas, a cup of sweet potatoes will give you all the vitamin A you need for the entire day. And you don't normally have that opportunity. Peas, when I was doing something on Good Gardens, what was it? Good Soils, Good Gardens. One of the things I did is I took all the vegetables that I could think of and I looked at all of their nutritional level. And then I took the vegetables that rated number one in a particular area, like for vitamin B1 or vitamin C or whatever. I did the minerals. I considered the fatty acids and everything. And the one that came out with the most number one slots was peas.
Mm.
So that's a very nutritious vegetable. And, of course, beets, and we were talking during the break, that you can eat both the bottom of the beets and the top of the beets. And also there are other plant parts that you can eat, for instance, broccoli leaves, cauliflower leaves, anything in the cabbage family, you can eat the leaves as well as the stems. Now, they may not be the best tasting because they don't breed them for that, whereas collards are bred for taste. They're bred for tenderness and all those sorts of things. And I think I've said this before, but cabbage, cauliflower, kohlrabi, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, they're all the same plant botanically. But over the years, over the generations, they've been bred to accentuate certain aspects of the plant. Like the Brussels sprouts, they bred it so that it would produce big axillary buds. Or broccoli was a inflorescence or a flower. And we eat that bud before it opens. Actually eat it before it even swells up. But so all the leaves on those things can be eaten.
So let's go back to the broccoli, and you said you can eat the stems. How do you make them desirable, palatable? You grind them up, you do something with them?
Well, one of the things you see in the store is broccoli slaw. Yeah. They'll just grind up the stems and then mix them with other things and just fine. Now, what we tend to do when we are taking the florets and we want to stir fry them or something, we'll actually cut the stems into sections and maybe slice them half or a quarter, and we just stir fry all of it together. It tastes fine. It's mild. It's sort of like a cabbagey taste to it. But if it's not old, it'll be, especially as you get closer to the inflorescence, it'll be tender. As you get further down, it might be a little tougher.
I just remember.
I hear some people like to peel the stem and then cut it up.
Yeah, you can do that. I try not to peel anything if I can help it. When I grew up, I didn't even like potato peels because my mother always peeled them. But as I got older, I realized that the majority of the nutrients many times are in the skins and the peels. And you also get a deeper potato flavor when you leave the skins on. Mm. So I started leaving them on, and I don't peel my apples. I eat the skin. And I even had a pastor once that when he ate an orange, he ate the whole thing, skin and all. Now, I haven't gotten to that point yet, but in certain dishes like orange tofu, not orange chicken, but orange tofu, one of my favorite restaurants, they actually used to stir fry sections of the orange peel right in the dish, and it was delicious. Of course, it had peppers in it too, and I just really enjoyed it. It was quite slightly crispy, but it had a very nice citrus flavor, so we throw away a lot of stuff we can eat, including weeds that grow in our garden.
So we may not be throwing away quite as much in the future.
You can eat pea shoots too, can't you?
Pardon?
Pea shoots? They're edible, aren't they?
Yeah, you should be able to eat them. Of course, you're going to give up a lot of your peas if you're eating the shoots. You could also eat fern. What do they call them?
Fiddleheads.
And also when the hostas are first coming up.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When they're just starting to come up, you can cut those off. They taste something like asparagus. And, of course, anybody that knows of the weeds, purslane is edible. And
we've had that, Tom, haven't we? Purslane salad.
Yes. In fact, my garden is very rich in those.
Yeah, redwood. And they're most likely very nutritious. Red root pigweed and also lamb's quarter. There are a number of things that grow, and you can even eat pokeweed when it's young. The leaves are very young. You don't want to eat it when it's older. But there's a lot of stuff, and so you might want to learn some of these things just in case things get a little rougher. Americans aren't used to missing meals. So you have to know where you can go look if things get a little tougher.
So let's, for example, could you plant peas at this time of year and know that you're not going to get peas, but you can still harvest the shoots?
It's going to get too cold too fast. They would probably germinate, but I doubt you're going to get much size to them because it's already getting cold outside. And when the temperatures drop, it takes longer for seeds to germinate. But what you could do is radish seeds and broccoli seeds. There are a number of different things that you can grow inside, and they just call them vegetable sprouts. And people will grow them and then cut them off and put them in salads. And they have different flavors, and you can let the plants continue to grow and continue to harvest. Now, some people claim they're more nutritious. I haven't seen any science papers that prove that yet. In the way I think, the plants have to produce the nutrients, and all the nutrients that a plant needs when it's getting started is already in the seed. And then once they start growing, they start producing nutrients as they get older. So I would think that they'd be higher levels of nutrients as the fruit and the plants grow. And I'll give you an example. I looked up the nutrient level in a green bell pepper versus a red bell pepper.
Okay.
And the red bell pepper had higher vitamin C content, and I don't remember what the other nutrients were, when it was ripe, because a red bell pepper or a yellow or a purple or brown, those are the ripe peppers. When they're green, we call them mature. In other words, you can harvest them and eat them at that level, but they're not going to have the highest level of nutrients that that plant can offer.
Sounds good. Are you ready to talk about processing the harvest there? Well, even let's talk about harvest. Anything to be thinking about on our harvesting for the month of October?
Well, you want to start getting out your warm season crops first, because we'll start getting a frost sometime in October. And warm season crops like melons and tomatoes, peppers, squash, at least the summer squash like zucchini, will not take frost. So you want to get those things harvested. And some of them, like the tomatoes, will ripen inside the house. I'd keep picking beans as long as they're producing, but they're really going to slow down a lot because we're moving into the colder weather. But if I've watched some weather channels that said we're going to have some warmer times in October, and if that's the case, if you've been harvesting, they'll continue to produce.
We were super blessed last year with the extended season. And
yeah, and if we have that again, you'll be able to get some other things. Now, any cool season crops like cabbage and Brussels sprouts and those types of things, they can even take a light frost, and the flavor will actually improve a little bit with the crucifers or the cruciferous crops, and they won't go down as quickly. Now, if you get a freeze, which means that the liquid inside the cell freezes and the cell bursts, then you've lost it. So this time of year, you should be listening to the weather forecast for how cold it's going to get at night. And in our area in Lansing, it got down to about 37 already. But it didn't do any damage to anything because my houseplants are still outside.
Yeah, we had a frost here in our neighborhoods.
I'm not surprised. Yeah. Now, on the processing, the reason I put that there is because depending on what you're processing, can cost more or less. For instance, once you can something, it can sit on a shelf for a year or more, depending on what it is. Now, nutrient levels tend to go down a little bit, vitamins more than minerals. Minerals are elements, so they're stable. But when you freeze something, it takes energy to keep it frozen. Whereas you use your energy up front when you're canning, and then there's no more energy required to keep it. The same thing would be the case when you dry. You dry something up front, and then you store it. And as long as you store it in the proper conditions, at the proper moisture levels, it'll last a long time, like dried blueberries or something like that, dried tomatoes. But if you don't do it right, then and you don't have the level that you need in terms of moisture level, which is usually pretty low with dry things, then you start to get mold growing and it won't store as well. Of course, freeze drying can last quite a while, but freeze dryers are thousands of dollars. So that might not be the most economical way, but you certainly could hold nutrient levels a lot longer with a freeze dryer.
You know, there's a number of ways to do processing. There are right ways and wrong ways, but there are some variants. We're coming to the bottom of the second segment, so maybe we'll hold that thought and give a reason for our listeners to stay tuned. We'll be right back.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org. And there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. click on that, and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Well, listeners, we're back. The Garden Guy and his cohorts, Tom and Sue Majeure. So, hey, Gary, when we left last time, we were talking about processing. We're talking about freezing and talking about drying. And it's just this morning, I have a customer who buys tomatoes. We call her the Tomato Lady. And I found out just recently that in her cell phone, she knows me as the Tomato Man. So we don't even have last names. But anyway, she came to me largely because she cans tomato juice. This morning she was telling me that how simple it is to do tomato juice. It's just interesting. Sometimes we get in our ruts and we do our own things. I don't think she does tomato paste, but
that's too much trouble.
She's done sauce. So everybody has their own little specialty. You got any secrets? Are you much of a canner?
Oh yeah. As a matter of fact, I just did an experiment on canning mandarin oranges.
Okay. And why do you
why did I do that? Because all the mandarin oranges you buy in the store now come from China.
Okay.
And the only place you can get them from Spain, which is the other country that was competing with China, is from Trader Joe's.
Okay.
And that will
they got the corner out, they bought the market?
Well, I think part of it is the Chinese were beating them in price because one of those cans, and it's not even the large can of fruit, but it's kind of like two-thirds or three-fourths the size. It's like almost $6. So I said, let me try this and see. And I happened to stumble onto a YouTube video that talked about how to do this. And one of the things you have to buy is an enzyme that will dissolve the white material that you find on the fruit. Because mm-hmm. when you buy the mandarin oranges, they have no skin or anything on them. They're just perfectly clean. And so what you do is you mix up a little bit of this with water, and then you put all your segments in there and let it sit overnight, maybe a little bit longer. And then you make up a sugar syrup. I tried a light syrup first, but that wasn't sweet enough if I was trying to get to what I had in.
Does it affect the preservative characteristics, the level of sugar?
Well, I'm using it according to the Ball book. You have an option of a light, medium, and heavy syrup.
Okay.
But sugar itself will keep bacteria from growing.
Right.
But if you're going to do something like this, you definitely want to use the Ball Red book. And I use the standard 30 minutes because they don't have mandarin oranges in there. And, of course, you need citric acid ascorbic acid. You put a little bit in there. That's vitamin C. And they'll explain why you do all that, because certain things you want to make sure that you have the right acidity level. So it turned out pretty well, although because I didn't have enough sugar in there, they were just a little bitter aftertaste. So I'm going to try it again. But the other thing about canning that's kind of on the downside is usually every year when we can something, we lose a jar or two.
Yeah, that's true.
And one of the things we found out is if you're going to take things out of a jar that you've been canning things, use a wooden spoon. Don't use metal, because over time of beating metal inside that jar, I guess it weakens the glass and it makes it more likely that the glass is going to break. So we're going to try that and see if we can have less breakage. But we had about two or three jars break. And of course, you go through all that work, whatever you're putting in there, you can't eat it.
It's a total loss.
It's a total loss.
Let me ask you this question. When it breaks, I did some loads to help out and so on and so forth. When the bottom of the jar breaks off, what have I done wrong to just the end of the glass?
It's probably just the fatigue of the glass. You didn't do anything wrong. Mm. So sometimes we'll have it break along the side. A lot of times it'll break in the bottom. But the jar's just weak. It couldn't take the heat. If there's a big change in temperature, glass can break too. So
would it break in that around the bottom of the glass? It's like, you know, about a quarter of an inch or less off the bottom.
Yeah. Now, are you putting your glass jars up on the little stand that they give you? Or is it on the bottom of the...
I think that they have a little plate in the bottom, yeah. Aluminum plate.
Yeah, I'm not sure other than just having the problem, and you might want to talk to a home economist on this.
Sure.
They still have them in the extension office, okay. So they may know a little bit more about that. But, yeah, we like to make our own tomato soup. We will can whole tomato. We normally freeze green beans, but once in a while we'll can some. We make all of our own applesauce when we have apples. And we just like canning. It's so much fun. My mother-in-law used to come down every fall and help us to can, and we just had a great time.
Well, good. Well, what else?
We missed our salsa weekend this year.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we make salsa, too. And we can our own jalapenos. We don't buy them from the store because the salt content is so high in the commercial stuff. We decrease the salt, and in order to have the firm peppers, because they'll get really mushy if you don't use calcium chloride with it, and they're nice and firm, we can cut them the thickness that we want. And we also put garlic pieces and carrot slices in there because you see that in the stores too, and onion. And I just love the pickled carrots with the jalapenos. I love those as much as I like the jalapenos. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of canning, and even though our kids are gone, we still can. So,
yeah.
You know, there's some neat tricks. Like a friend of mine, first time I was canning peaches.
We did that too this
year. He taught me that you must drop one pit in each jar.
Why?
For the flavor. It does make a difference.
You know what? I've never tried that, but the peaches that we did this year had lots of flavor. So I've never heard that before.
Another lady thought her pears were kind of bland. So mm-hmm. She drops a lemon or an orange slice into eat with the peel in each jar.
Well, that'll certainly give it a different flavor. So, and then when we were growing strawberries, we would freeze the strawberries, and then when we would make the applesauce, we'd mix the two together and make our own strawberry applesauce. We've done apricot applesauce and various other flavors. And oh my goodness. And I got the idea from the grocery store, but it's so much better than what you get out of the grocery stores.
Fantastic. Well, let's give a little time to looking at the All-American selection of 2023. When is that all announced? Is that...
Well, they start announcing them in the fall, and what they've been doing over the last few years is they release others, so there might be more coming. Last year I had done a YouTube video and then found out they released some more, but it was a little bit late to tell people about it. But one of the reasons I'm talking about it in October is so that you can get your seeds as early as possible. So if you grow your own seeds, which is the best way to get these to try out, then you can get them early enough to be able to do that, because you have great difficulty finding them in a garden center because they're so new. Business opportunity there. So the first one that we're going to talk about are flowers, and they're both perennials. Actually, I think all three of them are perennials. And the first one is a regional winner, which is specifically the Southeast and the Northwest. It doesn't mean that we can't grow it in our area. It just means that it grows best in those areas. So we're in the Great Lakes region, and just about everything here is not Great Lakes, but I'm going to try some of these next year. And the first one is an echinacea called Artesian Yellow Ombre. And echinacea is the genus word for coneflower. And the coneflower, this one is, as I said, a perennial. It can be used as a cut flower. And it has an intense golden yellow bloom. And you'll see on that plant graduated levels of yellow. So they're not all the same. And it's a multi-branch plant. It can be grown. It's very uniform in terms of how this plant looks. So you know how some plants you'll plant and some will be a little larger, some a little smaller. Mm-hmm. Since this is a hybrid, they're all very uniform in their height. And they attract pollinators, so you might want to try growing this. Very low maintenance. Cone flowers don't require much. They don't have very many pest issues, so you're not likely to see them chewed up like you might see another perennial. And they're definitely hardy. They can go to zone 4A, so we're zone 5 in the Lansing area. And, of course, as you get down in Indiana, they're getting into zone 6. And so up here where you guys are, you're probably zone 5A.
Mm-hmm.
Go a little further north, you're probably getting into 4B. Then the next one is a Shasta daisy. And this one's also a perennial. And this one is called, let's see, oh, it's a regional winner also, West, Northwest, Mountain, and Southwest. And it's called Carpet Angel. And it's it doesn't get very tall, though. Most of the Shasta daisies that I have in my yard will get up to 18 to 20 inches, depending on the cultivar. And this one only gets to be 4 to 6 inches high. So it's almost like a ground cover.
Shasta daisies have been around for a long time, but this is a variant?
Yeah, it's just it's been bred to be short. And okay. The other thing, it's a white. It's also what's called a semi-dumble, which means the middle portion of the flower inside the petals looks like a second flower.
Hmm.
Some people might not like it, but it's kind of interesting. And it's... the bloom size is fairly large. Like I said, it's only 4 to 6 inches wide, but the bloom is about 3 inches across.
Wow.
So you might want to try that one, see what you think about it. And Shasta daisies, they're not cut flowers. They stink to high heaven. So I wouldn't go out there smelling them, but there's not a lot of pest problems on this one either. Then the next one, the third one, is a salvia. And this one is also a perennial. It's also called Meadow Sage. And this one, it was chosen because it blooms up to 2 weeks earlier than the comparisons, and very winter hardy and heat tolerant. So it will produce for you quite nicely. Also, it's another good pollinator plant. So if you want to attract butterflies and different pollinators into your yard, then this is another one you might want to try.
Now, isn't that usually red or some variant?
No. Pollinator plants can be a wide variety of colors. Now, reds, oranges, and yellows attract hummingbirds.
Mm-hmm.
But pollinators, they actually see a different spectrum of light than we do. They can see beyond our ability. And I think is it ultraviolet? I'd have to go back and look that out. It's on the higher end of the scale, so I think it's ultraviolet, that they can actually see patterns in the flowers that we can't see unless we have the right filters that allow our eyes to see it. And this one won a national award, which means it grows uniformly well all over the country. So this one you could grow in Michigan. As I mentioned, it's also a perennial. And the deer don't particularly care for it.
Well,
rabbits don't
thing.
Bother it. So that one's one you might want to try. Now,
well,
so,
you know, just as we're going into the last couple of minutes, Gary, we often talk about the lawn and lawn care, and the leaves will be coming down and different things that we need to do. So it's good to kind of do an annual visit on lawn care.
For October?
Yep.
Well, in October, it's getting to be too late to sow seed. So the other thing is, if you have problems with grubs, you've seen a lot of birds, you have to switch from Merit, for instance, over to Dilox or 7. I think we've mentioned that in the past. And also, if you want to roll the lawn just to get some of the activity of the moles under control, you can do that. Just don't fill your roller with too much water. You don't want to compress your soil. if you want to kill the moles and you don't want to trap them, there is some traps, not traps, but baits. They have bromethylene in them. You can put those in the ground and it'll take care of your mold issue. Although I'm a live and let live sort of guy now. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want to wait until it really gets cold, like going into November, then you can do a dormant seeding and the seed will just sit there. But you definitely have to put straw down if you're going to do that. Other than that, keep mowing the lawn at 3 inches. Keep it at the highest height. And we're pretty much going down in fertilizer at this point. We don't want to do any quick-release fertilizers at this point. If you're going to use a slow-release fertilizer, I'd probably put on about a half rate. And that's about all you need to do.
Okay. And what you've told us over the years, probably over the last 4 years, is that get your mower ready and have it put it away right. And
yeah, and I don't always do that. I've mentioned this before. If you're going to have maintenance that you need to take it into a shop, do it in the fall or winter because everybody gets to it in the spring. And normally what I will do is as soon as I stop mowing, I will change the mower blades, I'll change the oil, and I'll fix anything that needs to be fixed, grease all the connections, check the belts to see if they need to be replaced. Because there's nothing worse than having to replace a dry belt. That's kind of rough to do. It takes time. You have to take so many things apart. It may not be the case on all mowers, but on a John Deere, it takes a little bit of time. The mower deck blade or the deck belt is easy to change. It's you just have to take the deck off and roll it out and take the spindle covers off, and you can put that on pretty quickly. So, and then check out, see if there's anything else that needs to be done. If you haven't changed your air filter, get that cleaned out. So it's basic maintenance that needs to be done.
Just to remember that you've had an effect on me, so.
Yeah, I'm going to get to it this year because I'm getting tired of being behind the eight ball because it seems like something always breaks down when it's time to start to mow.
That's right. That's right. What about anything about mulching? Any words of wisdom on that?
Well, it's too early to mulch your strawberries. Now, if you till your garden after you clean it up, if you want to cover it with something, I would put a cover crop down, and you can still put a rye cover crop down in October. And as long as it's 40 degrees outside, it'll grow. And when it gets too cold, it'll just go dormant. And then if it warms up, it'll start growing again. So what that will do is it will help nutrients to stay up close to the surface because it goes up into the rye. When you till it in, those materials will be recycled into the soil. And also, if you're on a slope or anything, it can help with erosion if it's like a flower bed or something like that.
Oh, very good. Well, that sounds like a wrap, Sue.
It does, except for did we get to hear all of the America selections?
Oh, there was a
couple. Oh, we have some vegetables, but we can do that next month.
Well, folks, it's been a pleasure to have you along with Gary Heilig, the Garden Guy. We'll be returning next month with November, so stay tuned. Bye now.